Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 22, delivered on April 19, 2012. The title of this lecture is Risk.
Today, risk. This is not a topic that I would have taught in microeconomics even 5 years ago. Although risk is a crucial component of economic decision making, it tends not to be part of the normal pedagogy in introductory courses. And the odd part is that as a finance professor at the university, risk is the central issue in finance, which is a subdiscipline of economics. But in economics in general, risk is one of the driving, motivating, decision-making features in consumer and business activities. And I explain it like this. Risk is the uncertainty of outcome. And we don't know, for the most part, what is going to happen in the future. We have an expectation. But we certainly do not know what exactly is going to happen. Now, let me write this like this. Now, risk, this uncertainty, can come from several different sources. One of the most important sources of uncertainty is ignorance. We do not have enough knowledge to know exactly what is going to be the result of a specific decision we make. If we had, so we could have a lack of information that causes risk. That will be something that will be very important to us. Risk can also be a result of unexpected unpredictable events. That impact on what's going to happen. We just can't know. Another important factor in risk is time. The further into the future you go, the hazier the outlook becomes, almost always. But also that, in other words, time has this longitudinal component in creating risk, but it also has a latitudinal component. In other words, within a time frame, you might have to make a decision that creates risk in and of itself. For example, in a car accident, if you had more time, you could probably work out all the different ways that you could avoid the accident. But in that instant, when things just go wrong, you don't have that time right there, that time in that time frame, to make what would be the optimal decision. Now, you can look back later and say, well, I could have done that or this. But in that time frame, you just don't have the time. Your calculation abilities are not going to get you the best of all possible outcomes. Here's the thing. Like I said, we have an expectation for the future, for what's going to come of our decisions. That expectation is shaped by a number of factors. One of those factors that shapes our expectation is historical evidence. What has happened in the past? We use that as a guide, an imperfect guide, but it is one of our most important bases for economic decision making. And I'll write up here, economic decision making. Some of the factors that go into it. Again, historical results. In our own lives, especially, but we can also, as time goes on, take into account the results that others have had. To a greater or lesser extent, our reliance on that information is shaped by how much we trust those sources, our age, and also our cultural upbringing. Some people will listen to their elders. Some people will listen to their peers. Some people will listen to no one. But that experience of others does inform us. Oftentimes, especially during certain periods of your life, just before the teens and through the teens, you tend not to listen to older people, especially to your parents. Although you are, you're tending to defy those norms. And in the modern world, with Facebook and these other social media, the experience base, the culture of your peers plays a huge role in your decision making, for better or worse. Now, economic decision making. There are other factors that go into it as well when we're making our decisions for the future. There's historical results, there's the experience of others, and there's also cultural upbringing. Culture, and I will add into that religion, and a few others that might be difficult to define. Your sex has some to do with it too, whether you're male or female. Your sexual orientation can even have some impact on your economic decision making. We certainly know that these are playing in marketing. We are very familiar with how people, how these impact on us, how certain ethnicities, how certain cultures will react to certain visuals, to appeals to them, and all that. Your religion does play a part, although it is not as important as one might think, because in the religion, we have to make a distinction between the desired versus the desirable. In other words, it doesn't matter who you are. If you are, you're going to say one thing and do another. And certainly within religion, we will have religious values. We won't stick to those in our day-to-day lives. For the most part, we will react on other decision-making factors. Our religion will tell us to a small extent, and perhaps if you are deeply religious and very well disciplined, the desired and the desirable will come together. But for the most part, we might say, I don't believe in sex before marriage, and then we'll go out and boff every ass that's out there. That's just the reality of it. The people who spout these religious family values, they tend to be no different from anyone else. They'll do whatever. But religion does have some impact in economic decision making. Culture does more importantly, much more so, in your decision making. But now let's get back to risk here. Risk is simply, well, now, if you take my introductory course in finance at the university, or any respectable introductory course in finance, you'll find that risk has to be measured. We need measures of it so that we can get our hands around how to deal with it. Now, in terms of of numbers, we can reduce risk perhaps to a term like volatility. That's a fancy way of saying fluctuations. Now let me explain this. I'm going to draw a long timeline here. Time against cost. Specifically, cost of medical care, of health care. I'm not going to put any particular numbers to it, but I'm going to take you on a journey, sir. I'm going to take you through your life. We're going to start out when you are born. Now, you were kind of a scrawny baby, a little bit sickly. So there was, at the point where you come into the world, or even in your prenatal, there were costs involved. And those kind of went up in the first months of the pregnancy. Then they eased off a little bit. And then you were born, and there were some pretty severe costs with that. And then you had your usual baby illnesses. And then you were fairly healthy, and you got your childhood illnesses. And then you got into a little bit healthier period. And then in your early, in your 6 to 7 year range, you had your vaccines, you had your colds, you had a couple of boo-boos. And then you get a little bit healthier into the early, in the preteen. And then you do some stupid things and you hurt yourself, break a couple of bones with skateboards and things like that. And then you get into your 20s. And year over year, there's actually not a whole lot of cost for you. You get healthy. You begin to develop the herd, the immunities from being sick as a child. You don't vomit as an adult unless you're on a bender or something like that. But you don't get those illnesses that were racking you when you were a kid. And you're being okay. You don't take too good a care of yourself, but really, it looks pretty good for you. You get into your 30s and you try to stay healthy. But you get a couple of things, minor scares, and you get into your 40s, and you get suddenly, you find that you've got high cholesterol, and you get a couple of heart problems. You try to get healthy again, but by the time you're in your 50s, you're in the doctor's office getting meds, and you're getting... You got a cancer scare. They have to cut out your prostate. Well, there goes your sex life, but that's okay. You didn't have one. You were married. You get into your 60s. You're trying to stay healthy, but you're taking more meds. You're going to the doctor more often. You have a couple of surgeries. You get into your 70s, and it's getting a little more serious. You have to go to the doctor quite often. You begin to have problems with nodules in your groin. You're getting sicker more often. You have to go to the doctor quite a bit. And then you're in your 80s. You have a couple of major surgeries. Then you have to buy an oxygen tank, and they attach tubes to your kidneys. And then, fortunately, you die. There's your life. That is volatility. We don't know when these things will happen. So, and you don't. You can try to mitigate risks by being a little healthier and all that kind of stuff. going with the fads, going to the doctor regularly, getting your colon cleaned and your things like that, and having the blood workups. But nevertheless, it's going to happen. We just don't know what your specific profile is. We know it will happen. Now I'm going to take you on your journey through your life. You were born a little bit earlier. Not that you're old, mind you. Gee, easy, woman. God. Okay. But we get to this point in time. Now, you're in your early childhood years, but you're a very safe child. You don't go outdoors very much, but you do get some illnesses. You do have a broken bone here and there. And there's this whole thing with finding that you've got some illnesses, but they go away. And, you know, you go through your early years. But you tend to stay healthier, but there is, of course, those childbearing years. Those create costs for you. But then you stay healthy, as many women do. But then there's breast cancer, and that creates a long tail of treatments afterwards and medicines. But then you get past that, and you are very well committed to a good, healthy lifestyle. You have doctor visits and all that, but you then keep going, but you're getting older. You tend to stay fairly healthy, but there are illnesses. You'll live longer than a man will, generally speaking. And of course, eventually, you'll croak. The trick here is that these two people are not perfectly correlated with respect to medical care, medical costs. In other words, the ups and downs are not exactly the same. And when they're not exactly the same, they have the effect of partially canceling each other out. It's not just that there are no costs involved if you look at both of them together, but the randomness of the fluctuations begins to go away. In the same way that when I talk in finance about portfolio diversification, and I am very strong on this, and I make it very clear. If you buy just one stock or two stocks, you're the stupidest asshole on earth. Well, I heard a good tip on stock. You are buying risk you don't need. No one's going to reward you for risk that you could get rid of by buying more stocks so that the fluctuations cancel each other out partially. The same is true with healthcare. You're a fool if you just let these fluctuations hit you and hammer you. If I were to take thousands of people's healthcare profiles, not all of the same age, we would have kids coming into the pool out here, we would have old people exiting the pool in these early years of the timeline that I gave, over a large number of people, if I put all these together, and we actually do this in insurance classes, we show what happens as you put more and more people into this volatility profile. You will see that what happens if you're putting kids in here, old people in here, so that the timelines are overlapping, there's a hum. And it doesn't fluctuate, hardly at all. It's the cost of insuring in a pool. This is how we deal mostly with risk, by simply adding more and more of these highly volatile things to the pool. They're not perfectly correlated, they never will be, so each one helps to cancel out the randomness of the others. And ultimately, over a very large number of people, you will get a quite certain cost per year of the insured pool of people. Once we know what that is, and that's what actuarial science is all about, is a very cool field this way, you suddenly say, oh, well, anyone who's in this insurance pool, we'll simply charge them a premium per year or whatever of this amount of the home, and we'll add something to it for the fact that we're taking on this project as the insurance company. And then all you do is pay into it, and you would never ever face something terrible. Let me go back to that timeline here, and I'm going to show you just, well, let me do it with you, madam. Okay. Here is your income. Over your life. Do you see that if she were to try to bear this cost volatility on her own, she would be ruined here, 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 and here. She'd be gone. Well, it wouldn't matter here. She'd be gone here. She'd be ruined, bankrupt, destroyed, wiped out, completely wrecked as a person. You see, if she tries to bear it on her own, she'll be destroyed. If she's in the insurance pool, she will not. The insurance will pay for what happens to her. So, in other words, this insurance concept not only levels out the risk over large numbers of people, it also removes the possibility, if it's really good insurance, which oftentimes it's not, of what we call, it's a variation on something in probability theory called gambler's ruin. You see, if she were to survive paying these, she would be okay for many, many years. It's just the fact that when you're a gambler, if you have one loss that is big early on, you don't get to keep playing in the game. And that's what happens in her life several times early on, before she can uptake her income and all that. And then, of course, the disaster comes when you're old and your income is declining, and then pretty much all you can afford is cat food, and you have these high health insurance costs, health care costs, you're ruined. But if you are insured, you are not ruined. In these times in your years when you just get these very expensive medical bills, and in your later years when you just don't have the income to afford it, as long as you have participated in this insurance pool, you won't be ruined. That's the power of insurance. That I have a very, very important concept, and that's the whole reason that we do insurance, is so that we can take large numbers of people, and that takes away this randomness. It doesn't take away all the costs, don't get me wrong. It just simply takes away the volatility of cost, and it also takes away on the consumer side the possibility, which is very real, of ruin from one healthcare bill that could wipe you out. And that pretty much, we know quite well, for example, that people who have gone bankrupt tend to live shorter lives. And one of the big sources of bankruptcy is healthcare bills. And people lose everything in these, when the hospitals and the doctors sue them because they didn't pay the bill, they lose everything. And that tends to shorten lives. So essentially, this gambler's ruin that can happen is real, and it will just simply clip off your life at a shorter, at an earlier age. So there you are. Risk pooling is the big, big way that we deal with volatility. And it's not just for people with health care, it's for all kinds of things as well. It has to do with, okay. The two broad areas of insurance are life and health and property and casualty, L&H and P&C. If you go into insurance as a major, you will find that you will early on know which way you're going to go. If you are interested in the insurance of life insurance and health insurance, that takes you in one direction. If you're interested in insuring things like cars and buildings, that's property and casualty, and people, that's against injuries, that's property and casualty, a different area. And there are these high-powered licensing exams that you'll take. You'll take the CLU, the Certified Life and Life Underwriter, and then there's the CPCU on the property and casualty side as part of your professional development. Okay. Risk pooling is the way we usually do it. Now, there are other ways you can deal with risk. One way is, and some companies as well as people do this, but companies you will find they self-insure. In other words, they are always adding to a certain amount of money that is saved so that they have the money when there is some serious medical problem that happens in their lives. Or the companies will tend to put a lot of money into the bank, some money every year, so that if some disaster happens at a factory or something like that, they have got the money to take care of it. Say that again? Well, municipalities have two tricks. One is they have a loss pool. They have their own loss reserves, I'm sorry. But also, a trick that many municipalities do is that they have these mutual insurance groups. A group of towns or small cities will get together, and they will do a kind of, all right, a loss to one is a loss to all, and we'll all cover the loss to one. That is extraordinarily popular, and you see it all over the country. Out here, municipalities, some things they insure with traditional insurance products, other things they tend to insure through these insurance pools that they create, mutual insurance pools among cities and towns. The issue there is, of course, that you have to make sure that all of the cities and towns are abiding by best practices with respect to risk mitigation, safety issues, and all of that. So there's a cost involved in monitoring the performance of each of the towns, because there would be an incentive for some town to contribute to the pool but then be very loose and lax in its own safety standards, and then it keeps hitting the pool over and over again for losses that the other members have to help pay for. We'll get into that in a minute here. Insurance, however, is a large, huge industry in the United States and, of course, across the world. And it has provided extraordinary benefit to many, many people, to companies all over the world. There are, however, problems with insurance. Now, there are problems with people being insured, and there are problems with insurance companies that do insurance. Now, on the people side, here are some of the problems with insurance, with risk pooling as the way to handle volatility in costs. Okay, and I'll put this on the consumer side. Perhaps the largest of them is what we call moral hazard. Now, I will make a distinction here that would not be made in a traditional economics textbook. In insurance, it's well known that moral hazard is actually two hazards. There is one that is called true moral hazard, and then there's another one that's called morale hazard. interestingly enough. But we kind of, in early courses, or in just sort of summaries of risk and insurance, we tend to lump them all under the term moral hazard. But know this, there are actually two different hazards here. Moral hazard is deliberate. Morale hazard is unconscious or not planned. Moral hazard is the tendency to bear risk that is indemnified. Now, the word indemnified means covered or insured against. It's a fancy word, but it's great to have it so that you can impress people. Here's what I mean by this. If you are insured, you will tend not to be as careful about the things that could cause the insurance to perform. An example of that would be, okay, I am a deliberate one. Well, I'm insured, so I'm going to go out and do something that is risky, and, you know, if I get hurt, I got insurance that'll cover it. I'm insured. Now, the other side of that, though, is that you can have unconscious ways that being covered, being protected, having someone guarantee take care of it if you have a loss. Sometimes that's just unconscious. You just don't think about it. An interesting example of the blend of moral and morale hazard might be the introduction many years back of birth control pills. Now, I don't know if I've mentioned this before to you, but I probably should bring it up now. People have sex. Oh, easy. Okay. Yeah, I know. And sometimes when you have sex, this thing called a baby can happen. You know, it's really kind of sucky, but it can happen. But with the introduction of birth control pills, this opened up what was termed for many, even in scholarly literature, as a sexual revolution. We could have sex and we would not have babies as a result of it. So as a result of that, there was a moral hazard. Oh, you're on the pill? Okay, we can have unprotected sex. Let the good times roll, turn on the candy bar sign. I don't know what that meant. I know darn well, okay? By the time you get to the late 60s and into the 70s, you didn't even ask. You just had sex because it was assumed. You were bearing a risk, but you didn't even think about it because it was assumed that the girl was on the pill or something like that, or one of these other devices was in use. So the moral hazard transferred to morale hazard. Interestingly enough, you got another thing happened, which we will talk about later, which is what is called secondary hazard. When you are indemnified, a risk is gone. But because you lean into that behavior for which the risk is gone, you bring up an entire new class of risks. As a result of that, secondary hazard came into play because we were no longer too concerned about girls getting pregnant. And then what happens is we come into an era when we start to proliferate, as we had in earlier times, sexually transmitted diseases, what in my time were called VDs, venereal diseases. Now they call them STDs. I don't know why they changed the name of them. Well, okay, anyway, secondary hazard came about. You can be insured against one thing, but what happens is, because you no longer have to worry about that, you can just take on that risk because the risk is covered, it's gone. suddenly another risk shows up, something that was unexpected or certainly not part of the deal when you first started to engage in the behaviors for which you were indemnified. So morale hazard is a big one out there. Now, another one that is a problem on the consumer side is what is called adverse selection. It has two sides to it. Now, the best way to explain adverse selection is this. Those most in need of indemnification will be most likely to seek it and on the other side, and those least in need of indemnification will be most likely to avoid it. And it's almost like there's a kind of a duh in here when you say this, but it is hugely important. The first part of adverse selection. Those who are the most likely to be sick or to become sick are the ones who are the most likely to go out and try to get insurance. Those who are the most likely to drive like a blind trout and run over people and break their cars are the most likely to go out and try to find insurance. Those the most, well, it just goes on and on. This is why there was a dark aspect to the whole healthcare debate that came in 2009. You had the liberals calling for all of us to get together and be insured. All of us hold hands, sing kumbaya, we'll all pay into one giant government-sponsored insurance program, and then we'll all be, you know, happy together. But you heard the loudest voices in that from those who were the most likely to be needing heavy-duty health insurance. They were the ones who were saying, let's all get together, hold hands, kumbaya, kumbaya, now please help me pay for my medical bills, and the government will force you to. You see, that's the problem, is they call for it, and then they say, see, you could get this too someday. Oh, shut up, lady. No, I won't. I mean, or something like that, okay? The other side of it, though, is just as dark. People in their younger years, when they are healthiest, in their 20s and 30s, they tend not to go and get health insurance. Why should they? They are well off. They are the ones who will say, well, why do I have to pay into this company's health care? Because all I'm doing is paying for that older guy and his snot-nosed kids going to the doctor all the time. I don't need insurance. Why should I? They will when they are 50 years old and their prostate is enlarged and they've got high blood pressure and diabetes. Oh, I need health insurance. Everyone should join. You see, when you don't need it, you are going to avoid it. So you are going to try to clip yourself off from that overall risk pooling phenomenon. So you have both sides of it. Those who are going to probably need hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of health care are going to say, we all need to join together and have health care as one happy family. And those who think that they are immortal are going to say, I don't want to pay for that. I'm just as healthy as a horse. Give me another double cheeseburger with bacon and grease on the side. You see, on both sides, this is why there is an argument. And it's a valid argument for compulsory health insurance. No, both sides, shut up. STFU, you know what? You're all going to join, okay? No, don't keep, you older, sickly person, don't keep calling on everyone to join in because we're all in this together. And don't wave the bloody red flag of other people's illnesses so that you can have what you want. And you young people, get off your fat asses and join the crowd. We all have to do this. That's the only way insurance works. That's the only way insurance works, is if you have a large enough and diversified enough volatility profile on the pool for that hum to show up. Now, here's the third problem on the consumer side. It's called the third-party payer. Problem. The third-party payer phenomenon. This is one of the most significant arguments against not just government providing national health care, but also it's a major problem with any kind of health insurance. When I came out here, it's been about 10 years ago. Late night television, I found out that there is no such thing as late night television except for infomercials. And so I'd be sitting there half asleep just staring at the television, and there'd come on the infomercials. And there was one that just sticks in my mind to this day. Every night, over and over, they play the same damn infomercial. I don't know if they even play it. I don't watch television anymore. But I remember that song. Hover around, hover around, hover around. Have any of you ever seen the hover around commercials? My God, I kept thinking to myself, I should be recording this so I can watch it anytime I want to be pissed off. The commercials were about these highly, very, very nice motorized wheelchairs, basically they were. Padded seat. Just all kinds of maneuverability, incredible, incredible machines. And they're very expensive, extraordinarily so. They can run as much as $10,000. And, of course, you would see these people cruising around their hover-rounds, and you'd get these testimonies. First, they'd say, now, this hover-round might not cost you anything at all. And then you get this testimony from testimonial from some old lady. I ordered my hover around and I didn't have to pay one dime, not one damn dime. And now I can go see the Grand Canyon. Well, you know why she didn't have to pay a damn dime? Because your ass paid it. You all paid for that fat old cow who's too big to walk to go see the Grand Canyon. I'll dig you a giant grave out back, Granny. There's your damn Grand Canyon. I don't want to pay for your big fat-ass wheelchair that's motorized. Buy a dog. Have the dog pull a regular wheelchair. But there you are. You paid it. Because she could demand it. And remember how demand is based upon price? The higher the price, the lower the quantity demanded. Basic economics. Well, if you don't have to pay for it, you're going to demand the very best. There were those happy people. This big fat guy, his ass cheeks were hanging over. Have you seen Walmart? The kind of people who roll around in those motorized things at Walmart? They're not crippled. They are fat. You know it as well as I do. Don't give me that. Where the hell was it? Okay. But there you are. You see, that's the third party problem, is that when any third party pays your bill for you, you have an incentive to just want the moon. I mean, I have made the mistake a couple of times on dates. Order anything, lady. Wait a minute, bitch, that is expensive. No, you can't. Anyway, so you see there, and then there's the other problem, It's not just that you have that incentive to just ask for the moon and say, I gotta have it. Why?
Because it's free.
There's the other problem, too, is that the market dynamic. Remember those auctions that I talked about, the Dutch and the English auctions? They're such abstract concepts. But in real life, know the insurance companies, the doctors, are, and you, you're not getting together and fighting it out. How much is this? Are you kidding me? No, I'm not going to get that medical procedure done. You're asking too much. I'll go find someone else who can do it. You should have seen what happened during that healthcare debate. Everyone seemed to be ignoring this giant elephant in the room. So the small group of economists, and I was one of them, we said, you know what you ought to be first doing beyond anything else? You ought to be requiring that a list of 300 common medical procedures be posted publicly by every healthcare provider in the country. If you do not tell us how much this is going to cost, you will pay a fine, and if you keep violating this law, you will go to prison.
Oh, we can't do that.
Why not?
Oh, because there's all these complications. Every time a person comes in, it's a special case.
Don't give me that crap. I tried to find out how much it would cost to fix my hernia. Do you know how much it costs to fix a hernia? Rough? You know, okay. Well, you know what? After a year of looking around, I don't know either. I have actually asked doctors.
Well, it depends on what you find in there.
You know what you're going to find in there? Guts. Goo. Maybe a few, bones. And if you find my little pony, please, bring it out and wash it. Okay. But the thing, though, is that they will not tell you a damn price. My best estimate, I got out of range. It's somewhere between $15,000 and $40,000. That's all I can tell you. I don't know. You see, price transparency doesn't exist. Why would you want to know that?
We just bill your health insurance company. Ha, 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 ha.
I don't have health insurance company, you moron. Okay, you see, there's the problem. Is that with that third-party payer system, I am not even given the dignity of a free economic agent to make a price-buy decision. Because someone else is going to pay it. Well, what if you don't have insurance? How do I know what the cost is?
Well, Will, you'll find out after the surgery is over.
Well, that's nice. You see, the third-party payer problem even comes down to deeper issues. In most cases, you cannot go to a doctor unless you have a third-party payer. You can't just say, I want to come in, have a doctor look at me. Well, what's your health insurance? I'm going to pay cash. Oh, we can't do it that way. Why not? Oh, we just can. You see, because the system becomes dependent upon the third-party payers. Because the last thing that the medical community wants is that auction to start. Now, I should point out to you that there are some small inroads that are being made now. Have any of you been over to the Meijer and seen that healthcare? It's like a little health clinic. They post their prices right. Oh, you want a flu shot? Here's the cost. You got a sore throat? Here's the cost. You got this? You got a minor infection? Here's the cost. Finally, you're beginning to see that inroad made. However, the medical community is fighting tooth and nail against that kind of activity because it does cut into their sales. Interestingly enough, in many, long ago, laws were passed that required that most retailers disclose their prices. They have to show the price right on a shelf. This happened with the grocery stores, actually, in the 1980s. But then the grocery stores started squawking because they said, we want to go to scanned merchandise, and we can't have these price transparency laws on the books because they're scanned. It would just add huge cost to us to still have to put prices on the shelves on each of the goods. The result of that was that a lot of these laws have just gotten very weak. And in some cases, the companies just simply violate the law. Have you ever gone to a jewelry counter at like Penny's or Kohl's? You notice that the prices aren't shown? You have to ask for the price. See, that's an old marketing trick. You pull it out and put it in someone's hand, and that makes them, that makes it yours, okay? That's exactly right. So they just deliberately break the law. The laws are still to a certain extent on the books, but no one enforces these price transparency laws, except with respect to gasoline. And as believe it or not, gasoline, that price transparency actually keeps the prices from going even stupidly higher than they would otherwise. But in many instances, I remember there were famous trick that was, it's still around, are these puppy mills that have these stores all over the country where you can go in and look at these cute dogs, and there's no prices. And you see a dog you like, and you'll say, how much is that dog? They refuse to answer. They'll turn around, go in, grab the dog, and stick it in your face. Here, hold this. And they will still keep refusing to answer the question, how much is it, until they figure you've bonded with the pooch. And that usually happens right after the little puppy is pissed all over you. But again, though, you see that problem with the third-party payers has all those different aspects. You tend to demand more than you your quantity demanded. It's way too high. Of the coverage and all that, you tend not to have the auction that pushes prices down to a competitive level, because essentially each healthcare provider in health insurance is a monopoly because you don't know its price structure. You can't auction on it. Okay, that's the consumer side. Let me go to the insurance company side. The insurance industry is heavily regulated. Don't get me wrong about that. It is probably, and that regulation is almost entirely at the state level. Now, the states work together, their insurance commissioners work together to create uniformity, but there is still quite a bit of variation. And to be an insurance agent, you get licensed by state. Now, oftentimes, a licensing in one state will have reciprocal recognition in some other states, but you still have to know the state laws from one state to the other. There are some states, for example, that require insurance companies to insure all comers. Other states don't have that. Matter of fact, it got so bad in New Jersey that one insurance company just said, we got to leave this state. You're making us insure people who are essentially Neanderthals driving. No, kind of thing. But the state forbade them from leaving. Insurance industry, again, is heavily regulated. To some extent, that is of their own doing. And the whole call, banking, securities, all these different industries to say, we can regulate ourselves. That cry has happened over and over again throughout history. Oh, why is this big government putting itself on us? We are so good at watching ourselves. Yes, and so is my four-year-old. They will just persistently go back to very bad practices. Government can overwhelm them and create major problems, but at the same time, knowing the history of any industry, you'll see why cracking down is always a good idea, and especially when you see the results that happen when we deregulate and suddenly all hell breaks loose and they're pointing, it's, oh, the cat broke that. No, you broke that. And we nearly, in the last case where we had taken the regulation off the banking industry in 1999, we came to, okay, within 2 hours of the entire financial system of the world collapsing. And once it collapsed, we wouldn't have been able to put it back together again. 2 hours. That's all. Because they could self-regulate, they bleated and farted. And finally, the Clinton administration's neoliberals said, okay, fine, we'll just take it all off you, the regulation. And they went right to the practices that they had been doing in the 1920s. And guess what? We still haven't cracked down on the banking industry. You think that bad? You don't even, well, most people don't know how horrible it got. The recession we had was merely an echo of what happened underneath. we're even worse off now than we were then. And everyone's saying, ah, there's no elephant sitting there in the middle of the room. Don't believe your lying eyes. Let's get to insurance companies. Here's one of the favorites, cherry picking. Cherry picking, choosing the lowest risk clients to insure. What that does, you induce those ones who do not cause high payouts to jump on board you, and that just makes it more expensive for everyday average Joes to get their insurance. Cherry pickers are out there, and you can even hear them. They don't call themselves cherry pickers on television, but listen to the ads for some of the insurance, the auto insurance companies. If you have a safe driving record for the past 7 years, you are one of our kind of people. That's a cherry picker. You've shown evidence that you are a low risk, low payout probability, and therefore this company is going to want your ass because they will not have to pay much. They can charge you your premiums, lower premiums, and of course you'll go with that. Hey, lower premiums. You'll go with them, and then that leaves you out of the general pool for the other insurance companies. Now, ultimately, what can happen is, as it is in the United States, you have more or less a three-tier insurance system in property and casualty. In property and casualty, you have the cherries, the really good, low-risk. They tend, we watch by profession, by education level. Sometimes there used to be a company called Educators and Executives. All it did was insure teachers and executives, both groups being very low risk. They're boring people. They tend to not do things that are dangerous with their cars or with their houses. So that Educators and Executives went for them. So the top tier is the cherries. Then there is this middle tier, which is the average everyday kinds of people. And then there is what's called the substandard market. The substandard market, some of those companies are constantly trying to induce people in the regular pool to join their pool by making it look like they're not a substandard carrier that primarily insures high-risk people. Does anyone know a company that is actually a substandard carrier, but it's constantly, yeah?
Safe Auto.
What's another one? Huh? No, Progressive. It is historically the place you go when you've got DUIs on your record, when you've got all kinds of bad things. They'll insure you at extremely high cost. Safe Auto would too, but they will market. We offer great rates and we want you. They're trying to pull in people who are normal, who have regular payout losses and all that, so that they help to mitigate a little bit of that high payout from the people who are basically driving while autistic. I shouldn't have said that. Okay. The problem, of course, there is, though, that the cherry pickers are the worst in the sense that what they do is they deny the larger pool, that low-risk group that is part of any kind of insurance. You have to have high-risk, low-risk, high payout probability, low payout probability in order for insurance to work. This is one of the greatest dangers that is coming, and it's already rumors that I've gotten from people on the inside of the industry is that it has already started. It has already started, and it will certainly be a controversy in the coming years. And of course, that controversy will suddenly just simply become just, oh well, we have to do it anyway. It's just necessary. It has to do with DNA profiling. Being able to tell, they claim, And this is the danger, because historically you've had things like this before. All through history, you've had these scientists, or before them the seers, before them the prophets, who said they could see your future. And with these new genetic DNA people, they've convinced the courts that DNA evidence is beyond controversy. That's bullshit. It's an absolute lie. It is one of the most amazing things. It's a laugh fest. But these insurance companies are convinced that the DNA specialists will be able to tell them when you will, not if you will get cancer, but what kind of cancer and when. They'll be able to tell when you will go get your Alzheimer's on. They will be able to tell when you will start getting nodules in your groin that will scare girls away. They will be able to tell you when you will die. That's what these DNA people are claiming. Oh, these geneticists, we can see the future. All the things that we talk about, the fate versus destiny, what you can do to improve your life, to keep yourself from getting ill. Why would I bother? If they can tell me the hour of my death, they can tell me that my emotions like anger and love are nothing but a bunch of goddamn chemicals? Really? That's what they're doing. And the insurance companies will love themselves this stuff, because then they'll say, oh, you're going to get breast cancer when you're 42 years old. We're not going to insure you. Or we'll insure you, but you're going to have to pay terribly high rates. We will classify you by your DNA profile. And you'll say to them, what the hell is this about?
Well, we know the future of you, ma'am. We're scientists.
What do you say to that? Do you believe it? Most people are going to absolutely freak when they find these things out. Well, you know, there's another thing to it. You know what? Go to hell. If I, you know, I'm aware of cancer, I'm going to watch myself. I'm going to take care of myself. If I catch a lump, I'm going to catch it early. I'm not going to rely on some mammogram. I'm going to eat less red meat. I'm going to exercise more. I will do things. I will show you that I am not bound by fate. I've got my own destiny. You see, that's the problem, though, is that with the DNA profiling, they'll be able to cherry pick you, and you won't even know that they're doing it. As long as they've gotten a hold of your database, your DNA database, there they'll have you. And then you won't know why you were denied insurance. You won't know why your premiums are higher than someone else's. Like I said, it will happen. It will be a controversy for a while. But of course, the controversy will eventually come down to, well, we're going to do it. That's cherry picking. Here's a very grim practice. Redlining. And it literally comes from the world of real estate. Now, in my PhD, one of my PhD specializations was real estate and urban studies. And this is just a dark, very well-known story. And it actually is illegal now, but it is still done. In real estate, essentially, the assumption, and it's a valid assumption, unfortunately, is that white people want to live with white people, black people want to live with black people. So in real estate, what you would have, back in the old days, real estate agents would have maps of their territories where they had houses for sale, and they would have literally red lines. These are the Negro communities. White people who come to us looking for a house, well, we won't take them into those. We won't. In the old days, they'd even create brochures. They were the white people brochures you give to the white people, showed only the listings in the white neighborhoods. And black people, they got the black neighborhood listings. That was redlining. Literally, I saw red line maps. We had some historical examples. I had a wonderful, high-powered just guru of real estate and urban studies as one of my last professors. And he had maps, and he would put them out. He said, these were the ones. They were old and worn red lines all over the place. He had red line maps for Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and he had one for Boston. Just amazing. They did this? Yes, they redlined. Now, redlining is illegal as hell now, but it's still done all the time. And I'll tell you a story from a friend of mine, and I won't mention his name because he is a dear friend. He's a great guy, although he's kind of a weird guy. I remember that we were in he drives a Lincoln Continental, and we were just driving along chatting, and he said, you know, I got some samples of Viagra in there. Would you like to grab some? What? What the hell is that? He's weird. He also eats peanuts without taking the shell off. Just, weirdest ass guy. But anyway, He told me how it's done these days, because I stepped away from real estate as one of my fields of interest. Although urban studies is still a major thing, the real estate aspect. And he said, here's how we do it. He said, you know, we got a couple who comes in looking for a house. And they said, well, we saw some of your listings, and, you know, we're kind of interested in this house right here. He says, well, what he does is, okay, that is in one of the black neighborhoods here in the Twin Cities. So what he does is he gets them in the car and he just drives them. He doesn't drive them right to the house that they were looking at. He drives them around and around the neighborhood, preferably on a Saturday afternoon when all the black kids are out and the black people are walking around and the black people coming out of their cars. He just drives them around for a half an hour until they say, you know what, I kind of like to look at some houses in another part of town. That's how it's done now. It's redlining by mutual consent. Okay? No one ever says, oh, that's a black community, you don't want that. You don't have to. You just make sure that they know the kind of people who are in that community. They're not your kind of people. Now, he'll do that with black people, too. He'll drive them around in white neighborhoods until they get tired of seeing crackers wandering around. Dirty stuff, but it's there. Here's the deal. In property and casualty insurance, redlining is done, or it was historically done. It is now illegal, but it's still done through various mechanisms. You see, old knowledge. Black people tend to have higher health care costs than white people. Old knowledge. Black people tend to have their houses burned down more than white people. Old knowledge. Black people tend to be involved, hurt in car accidents, in fights, in all kinds of things more than white people do. Therefore, we must redline and charge higher rates to black people than we do to white people. Now, you see, this was actually in the news this last month because a black man is suing because the health insurance company wants to charge him higher rates than his peers who are white because of his higher probability of having heart disease and a heart attack. Black men in their 40s tend to have a higher rate of heart attack than white men in their 40s. Okay? Sounds altogether business reasonable. There is a reason, and it should not be prohibited. There's clearly an actuarial issue here. But in fact, there isn't an actuarial issue there. And in fact, almost every time you hear race being used to divide people by some behavior, what you are actually seeing is income as the dividing factor. It is not that black people have a higher rate of heart disease, black men have a higher rate of heart disease. It is that black men tend to be poorer than white men. It is not that you have more fires in houses that black people own than white people. You look at income equivalents, you will find out that in fact, more fires happen with poor white trash than they do with poor black trash. You find out that the whole myth that blacks are inferior or somehow more expensive is bullshit. It was always, and it always will be, about income. The rates of welfare dependency are not higher for blacks and whites. In fact, they are higher for white rural trash than they are for black people. Did you know that? The welfare queens are white. Disproportionately white. So you see, this whole idea that insurance companies have a justification for charging higher rates for property, for casualty, for life and health than white people, no. It goes down to income. You divide by income, oh, then you would have to charge poor people higher insurance rates than wealthy people. And that just wouldn't work. So we boil it down to a proxy. Black people tend to be poorer than white people. Hispanics tend to be poorer than whites. You see, and then suddenly the whole race thing just vanishes. It goes away into thin air. Redlining. Now, there's one last one here that's very important, but I think that's enough just to give you an idea of insurance, risk, and some of the issues that are involved in it. And in our lecture next week, we'll go beyond. I'm sort of setting you up for some larger issues that have to do with the lecture on Tuesday, which is income and prosperity, the wealth of nations and peoples. But that's all I have for you today. I thank you.